Green Gulch Zen Center. Spent a week there. And I met a... I talked for a while with an old friend of mine who was one of the senior priests there. He was about to leave Zen Center after living there many years and kind of go off on her own. So in the spur of the moment, I asked her, well, after all these years... I asked her a number of questions, but I asked her, after all these years at Zen Center, what have you... how's it affected you? How are you different? Seems like maybe a good question as you kind of reflect back on all those years. And she gave a nice answer. She said, I think I'm much more tolerant of others now than I used to be, much more open-minded and broad-minded. And I like the answer. But what it did for me also, it stimulated me to ask the same question of myself. How all these years of practice that I've had, how has that affected me? And I kind of immediate train of thought was I came up with three stages, in a sense, of what my of my practice and how it affected me. And I thought that it might be somewhat interesting to take these categories and talk about them a little bit. And I came up with kind of three broad stages. And the first stage was, or period of my practice, was primarily about developing, I didn't use the word, this is a word back then, but now, integrity, discovering what integrity is. And the next phase was a lot about discovering, about love, loving kindness, love, compassion, tenderness of heart. And then the third phase was discovering something about release, which is my favorite word for the word for liberation or awakening in the Buddhist tradition. And I spent some time after that thinking, well, what about this later years now? You know, there must be some other phase that's development after that. What have I done? I thought about it, I couldn't come up with a good one. And I thought, well, maybe that's enough. And rather than thinking that there's supposed to be something above that, what it is now is just do it over again. And do it, you know, deeper and more thoroughly. It's kind of an endless process of discovering deeper levels of integrity, of love, and release. When I first came, started doing Buddhist practice, I was doing Zen practice. And I was in college. And I started practicing pretty seriously after initial kind of introduction to Zen practice. I thought I kind of came to start doing Zazen, Zen meditation, and felt very much at home in it. And the sense of being at home in that Zen meditation, even though it was very difficult and very painful, was something which I had never experienced before in such a... I never had access to it in any kind of sustained way in the way that I could just through meditation. And so I felt very strongly drawn to doing more meditation. And I had some, it took me about 2 or 3 years of kind of doing various things and getting my life a little bit in order. I had enough sense when I was 20 that I had to get my life a little bit better in order before I could really devote myself to a spiritual practice. So rather than throwing myself in before my life was in order, I spent 3 years getting it in order. And so after 3 years, the first year I didn't do much sitting, but the second 2 years of a 3 year period, I started a daily meditation practice at home, and I meditated twice a day, 40 minutes each time. And I was very strongly drawn to do that, partly because I was unhappy in my life. I felt I had a kind of a gnawing kind of ache inside of me. Something was wrong, something uncomfortable, some dissatisfaction. I felt lonely, I felt a little bit out of place. And I felt somehow that meditation practice was going to help me with this kind of angst or anxiety or achingness that I had. And it would make me a better person, and it helped me how to get more friends, because I felt kind of lonely. I thought, That seemed like somehow I thought that was a good way to make more friends, to sit quietly in my room by myself and meditate. Oh, did it work? And what happened after some time was that those concerns evaporated. And so rather than that those concerns were solved, per se, the concerns or the source of those concerns disappeared for me. And I've told this story many times, but I found it very strange that after those initial motivations to meditate disappeared, that I kept doing it anyway. And I thought it was very strange that I should do something then without any reason. And I spent a lot of time reflecting, because I'm kind of a rational kind of person who needs reasons for what I do. I used to very much so. And I was doing this thing without any reasons. I thought it was very, very peculiar. And I found out that after some time, the best understanding I could come to for myself was that my daily sitting practice was the deepest form of self-expression that I had available to myself. And nowadays, when I look back at that, I understand it to be a deepest sense of integrity, of wholeness, of being at home in myself, the deepest sense of being at ease, not with the world necessarily, but deeply at ease with myself, so that the normal preoccupations and anxieties of the small mind, of the egotistical mind, wasn't operating so much in the quiet of meditation. My fears, my insecurities, my ambitions and desires, my defenses of how I want to protect myself, and my concerns about how people saw me, and my concerns of being liked or not liked, and my concerns about school, and I was in college then. They all seem to kind of recede from me, kind of like falling off as I sit out and meditate. It's kind of like And I was left with some kind of state of contentment or ease. It wasn't very dramatic, but somewhere those kind of things weren't operating so strongly. And I was very strongly attracted to that state, kind of in an almost unconscious, subconscious kind of way, kind of pull towards this way of being. And so the only way I had access to it was through my sitting practice. And so I sat every day to touch into that. And I felt lucky. I think I was lucky that my first years of meditation practice, I knew actually very little about meditation. In Zen tradition, they don't teach you very much practical stuff. They don't have five-week introductory courses like I teach here. And I teach you and kind of mess people's minds up by telling them so much information. So I didn't have much instruction, and so I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing as a meditator. I just sat there, and I had some notion that sitting there meant just sitting there accepting myself, accepting the situation as it was. And I didn't know about concentration, so I didn't burden myself with the notion that I was supposed to get concentrated. I didn't even know, any clear idea if I was supposed to be in the present moment exactly. I just knew I was supposed to accept what was here right now. And so my mind wandered a lot, but that was okay because I didn't know I wasn't supposed to. So, from one point of view, I was kind of a dim-witted meditator. But another point of view, it was actually very wise. It was kind of beginner's luck, because I didn't have all these ideas of trying to get something and accomplish something and that I should be different than who I was. And so I was just able to just sit there in those two times a day for 40 minutes and just let all the various activities of the mind, which was always trying to improve on the situation or get away from a situation or protect myself or all those things, kind of let them kind of unwind themselves. And very much the experience in the early years of sitting for me was experience of unwinding all these habits and reactions of my mind, which were so much for me was very much fear based. And from that place, then a sense of what I call now a sense of integrity arose. And I understand now, over the years, as a sense of integrity or purity of heart it tends to become stronger for me, that it really feels to me as one of the greatest treasures that I have. It's the greatest wealth that I have, one of the greatest wealths. It counts for me much more than financial wealth or material wealth. And I would quite willing to sacrifice my material well-being sooner than sacrificing any sense of this inner sense of virtue or integrity or wholeness or this place in the heart that I know. And it was very interesting to me to watch how in meditation practice I could touch into some sense, it wasn't a very dramatic sense, but some sense of integrity. And you know, you have to realize that, you know, the reference point for whatever little sense of integrity I had was my completely neurotic, anxious 21-year-old mind. It was completely confused and upset and anxious. And so the difference was quite huge. So it wasn't like I had any great accomplishment. It was just that I'd relaxed a teeny bit. But it was quite different, the state of my being, my heart, my mind, in meditation than in my daily life. It was very interesting for me to watch, to notice and track the difference and how I'd go back into my normal life from my meditation sessions and how quickly my preoccupations and anxieties came flooding back. It is also very interesting to notice how my sense of virtue or morality or ethics or my integrity varied depending on how close I was in touch with this place I discovered in meditation versus how far away I was from it when I got completely lost in my anxieties, concerns, and busyness of my life. And in fact, that there were things that I simply wouldn't want to do. It felt like a great transgression against myself when I was in touch with a place of meditation that I was willing to do if almost unconsciously if I was kind of harried and running around being busy and full of preoccupations. And I started to have tremendous respect for that sense of integrity or contentment or ease that I touched in even lightly in my meditation because I saw the difference in my morality and the things I said and would tend to do depending on the state of mind that I was in. And maybe many of you have had the same experience. It's best not to talk ethics with people, ethical ideas, and when they're harried. You know, wait until they're really calm and settled and really kind of in touch with themselves. And then you can listen to, then you can have a much more sincere conversation, much more deep. And then in that early years of my practice, part of my motivation to keep practicing and the decisions I made to further my practice was not the opportunities to go deeper in meditation, but was the opportunities to extend that sense of integrity into my daily life so there wasn't such a big gap or separation between the two. And oddly enough, I looked for places, I looked for Buddhist meditation centers as places where I could do this integration work. So I went to meditation centers not to do intensive meditation per se, but I wanted to be around other people who were trying to do the integration work also. And so I could start learning how to speak with people and not be full of my own ego trips, that is the word I had back then, about, you know, how I speaking based on how I wanted people to see me versus just speaking what needed to be said. And that was a very hard lesson for me to learn. And I wanted to be around people who could support me in that effort. So I moved to San Francisco Zen Center and found it very helpful. And after being there for some time, I wanted to do it even more thoroughly. I could see them how, you know, I wanted to do it more completely in my daily life. And so I wanted a more intensive situation where it's kind of the whole situation, the whole context of the training situation was focusing on being mindful and present and practicing all day long. So first I went to Green Gulch, lived there at Green Gulch Farm. And then I went down to for about 2.5-3 years to Tassajara Monastery. And really the motivation to go again was not the fact that they did much more meditation at the monastery wasn't really the motivation. The motivation was here was a setting where the whole day was organized around trying to live out of this place of integrity. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to have the experience of living the whole day that way and not kind of losing touch with it because I was running around being busy and all that. And so that was kind of my first phase. And then And it was, I would say it was kind of semi-conscious, all this. What I find peculiar when I look back at my years of practice is the important things that were really happening to me in retrospect, I was not aware of while they were happening. And so that many of us, you know, measuring our progress and how well we're doing, and we have this idea of what's really important for our meditation practice and our spiritual life, and we're measuring, you know, the iota of differences in concentration from one day to the next or whatever, and or calmness or whatever, it might have actually absolutely no importance at all how concentrated you get. It's important that you try, but how concentrated you get might not matter. What matters perhaps is you're becoming more compassionate, or you're just discovering a sense of kind of ease of heart or contentment or settledness or self-acceptance. And you might not see that this is happening until years later, as in my case. So the next phase, it was especially this way. So I was there at the monastery doing my practice and loved it. I was very happy in the monastery. And you'll think the next statement is being very peculiar. My sense of living at the monastery was this was the perfect lifestyle. You think of that. I just thought it was a perfect lifestyle. It wasn't like a matter of, you know, I didn't want to live any other way. It just seemed like a perfect way to live. Getting up at 4:30 in the morning. And I continued with my practice there. And what slowly started to happen there in that context of more intensive practice and filling my life with the Dharma is some of the places of metaphorically around my heart that were guarded or held or protected, resistant to the world or people around me, or just simply too distracted to have my heart be sensitive enough to people in the world around me. I started to become, the shield started to drop and the preoccupation started to disappear. And this sensitivity, a tenderness and a sensitivity of heart, which is probably the best way of describing it, started to kind of blossom in my chest, in my being. It felt like very much like my chest area was kind of becoming more and more expansive and almost open, and like someone had taken a shield off. And I felt tremendously sensitive to the people around me, and filled with kind of a love and compassion and delight, and a kind of a feeling of wanting, kind of naturally wanting to respond to people. My first summer at Tassajara, I was I spent a lot of my free time, most of my free time, working in the garden. And I remember I'd get up in the morning and when I had a break, and I would just walk around the garden, and it was very difficult to be a gardener because I wouldn't want to work. All I wanted to do was walk around the garden and look at all the plants and see how they were doing. I just felt this, you know, tremendous kind of heart connection with each plant. I just wanted to look and see. And so, you know, plants are plants, nice. But it was that sense of kind of maternal. The word I used was kind of maternal care. It was a sense that was arising inside of me in the monastery. And from that also came a tremendous capacity for me of feeling, maybe the word heartbreak is a good word, heartbreak for the suffering of the world. I remember sometimes reading some newspapers or magazines of the times and just feeling this tremendous pain of the world, because it just felt that was happening to me or happening. And you know, this is, you know, just endless examples of this kind of situation, but because of the particular time in my life when I was so open, there was this Israeli bombing of Beirut in the early 80s. It was quite dramatic, and I'd been to Beirut as a child, so it was kind of, I'd grown up part of my growing up was in the shores of the Mediterranean in Italy. So I felt like it was, you know, in my backyard, kind of, I knew the place. And they were bombing it. And I remember opening up Time magazine and seeing photographs and reading it and feeling tremendously pained and grieved by this, and feeling it was so right for me to feel it. Not that it was right thing to be happening, but just it was the suffering of the world. This kind of suffering has gone on since beginning of humanity and will continue for a long time still. And the fact that it's happening, it felt like it was, you know, I felt it's the first time that I was a participant in this suffering in the world, in these kinds of atrocities. I wasn't just someone, you know, deep in the mountains of California in an isolated monastery, but I felt like I was a participant in those events. And it was very shocking to me. It was very, very deeply moved by that. And I remember feeling all this, you know, tremendous openness to people around me and feeling a lot of love. There's a stage of practice that some people describe where it's a little bit dangerous, a stage of practice. And that's a stage of practice, it's too easy to fall in love. Mm-hmm. You just fall in love with everyone. And, you know, you have to be a little bit careful about how you fall in love. Some practitioners then will confuse falling in love, which is a wonderful thing, with romantic love, which is maybe a different kind of love. And so if people aren't clear about the difference, then you can get into trouble. But I was, you know, fall in love with everyone, which is really great. I didn't have any sense that this was supposed to be happening in practice. I just knew it was happening. And it wasn't my intention for it to happen. I wasn't planning on it happening. I didn't really have any idea that it was supposed to happen. But it was what happened. It was great. And I remember also, as part of this feeling, this sensitivity, openness of heart, this love that was happening, I felt it was also born inside of me a movement of response. I remember one of the Zen Center teachers came, one of the abbots was there one day, and I hadn't seen him for quite a while, and I just passed him in the pathway, and I kind of whispered to him, and I said, you know, I think I'm becoming a response machine. And I meant that, machine is kind of a cold word, but what I meant was that I would kind of start feeling the situations around me, both with people and just with, you know, the kind of thing where many of us have, you see litter on the street, and, you know, you don't think about it particularly, but you maybe pick it up and put it in a trash can. You just kind of do it. Just, you know, no one's watching, so you're not going to get any credit for it. You're not doing it for that reason. So it was that kind of, the world opened up in that way. It seemed like the world was full of things that needed responding to. And I was just there in a present way, and it just felt like I was just there to respond. And it wasn't like me, there wasn't the self that was responding, it was what had to be done. And it came out of the sensitivity, this open-heartedness, this compassion and love that was arising inside of me. And it was great. And I use these words like great, the adjectives. I want to be careful and tell you that, and warn you, it wasn't that it was great experiences of love. You just have to realize where I was coming from. So you don't set me up on some pedestals, you know, like Gil was just full of radiant love, and, you know, the contrast was so great that I can talk about it. So then I stumbled my way, in a sense, into Vipassana in Thailand, kind of by accident ended up on a Vipassana retreat. And the context, in doing this mindfulness practice in a very intensive way, in my first long retreat, I got much quieter and stiller, more concentrated than I ever had been before in my life. And in that depth, really, I felt like I just dropped into a deep, 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 deep quiet, deep place inside of me, in the core of where I was. It was a sense I had. And in that place, there seemed to be some sense of self, like some core sense of self that just, we all have some sense of self in a kind of generic way, but some core kernel of sense of, this is, you know, a sense of self. And still being somewhat naive Buddhist, I didn't have any idea that was wrong. You know, people who learn too much Buddhism, listen to too many Dharma talks by Gill or something, will have this idea that, you know, Buddhism is about no self, and so if you find this core seed of self inside of you, you know, you're wrong. But I was lucky, I didn't have that idea. So I just found this little sense, this core sense of self and in that retreat. And then I left the retreat, and what was peculiar was it became essential for me to go and touch that place again. And I had never touched this place, and I had no sense I was supposed to get rid of it, but I knew I had to go and find that, and touch that place, that deep, deep place of the kernel or seed of self. And it became kind of a dark night of the soul time for me in my practice, because nothing else in the world had any importance for me compared to coming back and touching that place. And it was peculiar, you know, I had no particular reference for this need, this compulsion almost, this burning desire, motivation, but I had no other choice but to somehow go back into the situation and touch that place again. And until I had the opportunity, it was kind of like I was actually somewhat depressed and out of sorts. And finally I got the opportunity to go back to Southeast Asia. I went to Burma and practiced there some more. And in the context of practicing even longer in Vipassana, in my practice of Vipassana, I discovered the next phase of what I call, you know, these three phases, integrity, love, and release. And I discovered something about the nature of release, of perhaps what the Buddhist tradition calls liberation or awakening. And it turned out to be very closely tied to this core sense of kernel of sense of self that I felt. In that the experience of release is an experience where the simplest way of saying it is that where the last or any remnants of clinging, of possessiveness, of clinging, of resistance to the world, are released from our consciousness, from our awareness, from our presence. And that released consciousness is kind of unique, because it's certainly normal way of kind of experiencing the world is to we have awareness, and we identify that awareness with something as being the self. Some people will say, my body is myself, or my feelings are myself, my thinking is myself, my kind of generic sense of self is myself. But all those are actually objects that exist within our awareness. And it's a kind of way in which we shackle our awareness and we identify strongly to something as being, this is who I am. But to be released is to have that awareness in a kind of funny way, without it identified to anything in the world as being itself, including itself. So it's kind of like, have you ever had an experience where, I don't know if this is a good example, but maybe a big glass window is really big, and it's really clean, and you think it's a door, and you just walk into it, and suddenly you realize it's there. It's kind of like, you know, it's not, you're, or it's kind of like trying to touch, use your right hand to touch your right elbow. You know, consciousness which doesn't have an object for itself, doesn't relate to anything as being itself, you can't really get to it, because it's like, you know, how do you get to the elbow? So, but the experience of release, to have an experience of, I don't even like to use the word experience, because that, you know, is seemingly too closely subject to the conditioned world. But to have maybe just simply to have the release of our clinging, to have the release of all the subtlest forms of the grossest and subtlest forms of holding, of fear, of attachment, of holding some idea of who I am, some assumptions of who we need to be, is really one of the most marvelous things that we can experience in life. And in some sense, it can be a culmination of the earlier two stages of a development of integrity, a development of love. And I think the Buddhist tradition itself stresses that the ultimate goal is this release. And it's very important not to confuse integrity or love for the ultimate goal, the goal of release. And it can be so satisfying, the experience of integrity, the purity that comes from having kind of a moral heart, that a person can just simply take that to be the goal of the spiritual life. And it can be so satisfying to be filled with love. And people who meditate tend to experience love much more powerfully than any other people, because the strength of love is very much dependent on the strength of your concentration. The greater the concentration, the greater the capacity for love is. And you know, it's possible to be frozen in your tracks because the love is so powerful. You simply can't move. Kind of waves and waves of cascading sense of joy and delight and love just kind of moving through you. And it's very easy to kind of think, well, that's great, you know, love. You know, some people hold love as being kind of the ultimate good. But in both the sense of integrity and in the sense of great love or great compassion or great kindness, great concentrated states, there can still be very subtle forms of clinging to I-making, to making some sense of this is who I am. Say, oh, the love is who I am, the capacity to love is who I am, or something else. To kind of have some sense of I-making, to create some sense of self out of that and to hold on to that. And as long as there's some sense of... and also a very subtle sense of not really wanting to see reality for what it really is. A very subtle shifting the gaze away from really understanding, really seeing deeply what's really happening here in our hearts. And the experience of release is ultimately this experience of releasing any notion of identification, any notion of assuming anything as a self and holding on to that or possessing that. But to have a mind that doesn't waste any time, have an awareness, have a presence that doesn't waste any time assuming what it is. Isn't that great? Wouldn't it be great to go around life and not have to assume who you are first? So, and then I thought kind of very roughly these... And I thought, well, when I first thought this is not enough to have these three stages, I have to have another stage. Then I remembered, oh, but the Buddha had three stages also for practice, and they were roughly comparable to kind of things that spontaneously arose in my mind. The first is ethics, which is the same as integrity, and the second is concentration, which... I think states of deep concentration, rather than being kind of a willful force, kind of intense feeling to them, often come with a great expansiveness of being, of presence, of heart, and can often come with tremendous joy and delight and love. And then release, which is the Buddha talked about the wisdom. So ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And wisdom, the wise mind is the mind that has been released, understands release. And then in my own sake, having gone through these, I don't feel in any kind of way that Buddhist practice has finished cooking me. And I'm still being cooked and cooked alive. And it's kind of like I have to do it even more thoroughly and do it again and refine all this more. And there's more and more more for me to discover and more for me to realize and purify and release within me. So I continue on this path of integrity, of love, and release. And I believe that they are our greatest treasures that we can have inside of ourselves. And if you have those three as your treasures, as your wealth, not much else happens to you in your life will make that much difference. The path of love, I just kind of wanted to say this earlier, the middle section of love or compassion remains very important part of me. because it provides a great deal of the motivation for me for continuing to practice. Because I don't practice just for myself, but it seems that that sense of responding to the world and the world of suffering around me is very important for me, and that sense of responding is an act of compassion. And my choice to kind of go into to throw my life fully into the world of Dharma practice and just, that make basically my livelihood from that and make my life, the whole life that. It was a motivation based on this experience of compassion. And the experience of release tells me it's very important not to stop just to being compassionate. But the compassion has to be informed by the experience of release, so that we don't get if all kinds of problems can arise if you don't understand release. We start identifying with our compassionate acts. I'm the one who's doing this. It's just, it's being done. So that's my talk. I hope that was okay to give the personal talk. There's a tradition in Buddhism for Dharma teachers. It's more in Asia. You won't notice this in the West so much. But in Asia, for Dharma teachers not to talk about themselves. And so it's kind of interesting to reflect on why they might not want to do that. But anyway, in the West, we seem to talk about ourselves a lot. May all of America be released from self. Thank you all very much.